Hi, this is Paul. This is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current status of my Sunday sermon. This week, I think I'll probably be posting this Sunday morning California time, so it will be Sunday afternoon for a lot of you people on the East Coast, and it'll be Monday for you folks in Australia, so it's just the way it went. I had a good talk with John Verveghe today, and I'm going to post that tomorrow on Saturday when I usually post my Rough Draft for Sunday, so it's the way it goes sometime. I'm not that structured. The meaning crisis. For the good people at Living Stones, this will be sort of a introduction to it a little bit. The day before, I had a wonderful conversation with Kyle McNeese, who is a researcher in bioethics, and he and I talked through some various conversations and videos that I've been making with others, talking about how, in many ways, this is something that the guy in the upper corner here, Christopher, had made a comment on. Such a gift of poetry. Talked about the receding sun of Christianity in the Western world. And of course, I am not one who thinks it has to recede. And I think that God in his own providence brings things to wax and wane throughout church history. And we've seen this many, many times. How does that have to do with the rest of my sermon? I forgot. See, this is why I practice these things. Where am I going with this? Our lives have meaning because of the stories we inhabit. And so the guy in the lower left-hand corner here, John Verveghe, has been doing a long series of videos on the meaning crisis that's into a lot of philosophy and cognitive science. And the guy in the lower right-hand corner is someone who does meaningful conversations between people and facilitates transformative listening, and he lives in the Bay Area. And I was talking to Kyle about all these things and talking about all of the ways in which people feel this thing receding, and so often it seems on the heels of a sort of materialistic worldview. Glean this from a fellow pastor's blog. A series of quotes about stories. No, the adventure first. The adventure's first, explains. Explanations take such a dreadful time. It's a very interesting line from Lewis Carroll. All great literature is one of two stories, a man goes on a journey or a stranger comes to town, Leo Tolstoy. Stories have to be told or they die, and when they die, we can't remember who we are or why we're here. We live within stories, and when these stories go away, or at least the role that stories play in our lives, nothing else seems to matter. Pay attention to that word, because we're going to use it a lot in this sermon. If history were taught in the form of stories, it would never be forgotten. Yeah, that's true. And then the last one. After nourishment, shelter, and companionship, stories are the things we need most in the world. I like a lot of things about that quote, but I don't like the priority he sets them in. In the last three stories that we've read, Jesus sets out his hapless disciples with authority to cast out unclean spirits, and we talked about that 2 weeks ago. Herod confuses Jesus with John the Baptist, who he beheads. We talked about that last week. And this week, Jesus and his disciples regroup after the missionary journey to the towns and the villages, and they're going to go away on a sort of a retreat. Now, the last few weeks we've been talking about these great leaders who ruled by the sword and they lived by the sword. And, well, a lot of people think that Alexander the Great was assassinated. Napoleon was exiled and thrown out. I don't recall exactly how Herod Antipas dies. Something in the back of my mind says, not of old age. This is the way many times we assume the world should be ruled. And when Jesus was doing his ministry, everyone assumed that Jesus would rule this way because they very quickly saw him as a leader, but he didn't. So in the course of these three stories, Jesus regroups after sending out his disciples. We talked about the secret of his success. We talked about the limitations of what Herod could see by how he viewed the world. And now the apostles gathered around Jesus and told him all that they had done and taught. And he said to them, come away to a deserted place. Now, this brings echoes of the desert wanderings, where God leads his people out of slavery in Egypt and into the wilderness. Okay? Now wilderness often means a desolated place or an isolated place. It doesn't necessarily always mean a dry place. It does mean a place in a sense where especially human life is sparse, but sometimes other life is sparse. And we find Jesus again and again in the Gospels going out to these isolated places to pray, sometimes by himself. But here he tells his disciples, he's again in a sense modeling for them and training them in what he's doing, and say, okay, you've had your missionary journey in the towns. Now come with me out to a desolated place by ourselves for us to rest a while. And this rest is probably talking, probably hanging out together, probably doing some prayer, some of this. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure. Now the Greek word there is very interesting. It's eukaireo, which kairos is this certain kind of time, which is like the moment that something happens. Chronos is more the long time. Kairos is the moment, and eu is the good suffix. So eulogi is good logos or good talking. So eukaireo is they're going to go and have a good restorative moment together. That's what Jesus is looking for and telling his disciples, come away with me and we'll do this. Because they haven't had any of that, not even enough time to eat with each other. And so they went away in the boat, because they're fishermen, they've got boats, in the boat to a deserted place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they hurried there on foot from all the towns and arrived ahead of them. And as he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion for them, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. And so, even though Jesus knows what he and disciples most need is some eukaireo, okay, they're here, they followed us, they're like sheep without a shepherd, he had compassion for them, and he began giving them what they wanted, which was wisdom, which was teaching, which was learning. When it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a deserted place. This is what we came looking for, but not what we came to do. And the hour is very late. Send them away so that they may go into the surrounding villages and buy something to eat for themselves. Now, it's interesting because Jesus could have sent them away earlier. It's also interesting that, as we see so often with Jesus' stories, he seems to be setting something up here. But he won't tell us what it is, and the disciples, it might be one of these lessons that they don't really like very well, but Jesus is doing something. But he answered them, you give them something to eat. Then they said to him, are we to go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? That's 200 days' wages, okay? So that's the better part of a year. And the disciples are like, first, we don't have enough money. Second, are you really going to ask us to do this? This, you tell us to give them something to eat? And what Jesus begins to do now is, again, this is the secret of his success. He is different from all the other rulers. He begins to train them, and he says, how many loaves do you have? Go and see. And that command is right there in there. It's in the imperative. Go look. You go do an accounting and find out how much food you have with you. And they found out. And they said, 5 loaves and 2 fish. Okay. Then he ordered them to all get the people to sit down in groups. Now notice, he ordered them to do it. Jesus doesn't do it himself. He ordered them to do it. On the green grass, he makes me lie down in green grass. By quiet waters, he renews my soul. Psalm 23 is echoing through here. You've got both the desert and you've got the Psalms, and they're both here. So they sat down in groups of hundreds and of 50s. They're a little bit organized there, it seems. And taking 5 loaves and 2 fish, he looked up to heaven Mark does not leave out this detail. And blessed and broke the loaves. Now, this is very much like what happens at a date later on when he's eating with his disciples. Keep that in mind. And he gave them to his disciples to set before the people. Again, he is working through the disciples. And he divided the two fish among them all. And all ate and were filled. And they took up 12 baskets. So it wasn't that everybody got a little crumb and there was just kind of this miraculous thing in this crumb that satiated everybody's hunger. It was that the loaves and the fishes were multiplied. And how? Well, they just were. And all ate and were satisfied, and they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces and of the fish. So in other words, everybody had stuff to take home. Those who had eaten the loaves numbered 5,000 men, and we should also assume that there were likely women and children there with them as well. Now, why tell this story? And why talk about meaning and stories and whether they matter? Because does survival really trump meaning? I've been listening to a series of podcasts on the First World War. I'm very fascinated myself, and I've always been in the First and Second World War, and in the period between the wars. That time period is always held certain fascination with me, and so I listened to these podcasts, and there's the terror of it and the horror of it and the sacrifice and the bravery, sometimes the nobility, and just the baseness and brokenness. And war brings all these things out of us. There's stories of people giving their life for their buddy in the trench next to him. And just amazing stories of heroism and personal sacrifices out of love for the one next to them. But then also horrible stories. One story of a man who remembered when the attack came and the gas came, and he realized that his gas mask had been shot up and broken up by shrapnel. And he had just been talking to the guy in the trench next to him, who was just basically a boy. And he was thinking about, you know, this boy shouldn't be at war, and he had compassion on that boy. But once the gas attack came and he realized he was an animal, and he stole the mask off the boy and put it on himself and watched him die. And for the rest of his life, he was haunted by what he had done. He was tormented by it, and you might say justly so. But who of us can stand in judgment over someone in a situation like that? Why am I telling this story about World War I when we have this lovely story of Jesus feeding the 5,000? Because it gets into this question of bread and stuff and story and mind. It's interesting how Jesus wants to involve his disciples. You give them something to eat. You go see. They tell his disciples, the disciples say to him, send them away. And Jesus is like, oh no, this mass of people, you will shepherd. I will help, but you will shepherd. And well, we can't shepherd them. We don't have near enough money. But why have all these people? Now, these people aren't stupid. These people understand the way life works in the ancient world. They understand if they follow Jesus by the lake that they might not have something to eat or something to drink, or on and on with this. But they follow him. Why? It's the story. It's how he fascinates them. And even if they have to suffer, people will suffer for meaning. And as I said in the story, they'll be tormented by meaning. Now, neither did Jesus say, well, they don't need to eat. Let's just fast and pray with us. You know, for these guys going out on a prayer retreat, they certainly didn't bring that much food for at least 13 men. We don't know if it was just the 12 apostles, or sometimes there seems to be a group of 20, 75, 120 people following Jesus, and they didn't seem to bring enough food either. And so Jesus doesn't say, well, we're all going to fast and pray together now with the 5,000 men and whatever women and children followed them. See, Jesus is like a ruler, unlike every other ruler. See, many rulers rule with the matter verse first. They're matter verse first rulers, and they rule by the sword, and they use carrots and sticks, and they reward friends with riches and control enemies with violence. That's what we're used to out of our leaders, isn't it? There are some mind verse first leaders, and that might be harder for us to identify, but they encourage us to escape into distraction and bliss, maybe religious escapism, maybe circuses and drama. And actually, many of these mind verse first rulers are business rulers. I've been reading a fascinating book on the age of addiction that talks about how sugar and tobacco and all of these things that we have manufactured, entertainment and stories and movies. Well, these are mind first verse. Well, who cares about the body? Just let me get lost in a story. Let me be lost in the music. Let me be lost in song. Let me be lost in drugs. And what we see is this loss of agency in the matter, in the matter verse. We all seem to be one or the other. And Jesus is well accustomed to thinking of the mind verse, because disciples, we ought to retire and have some good time together. But what about the hungry people? You, my disciples, feed them. Well, we can't feed them. We have 5 loaves and 2 fish and not near enough money. Bring me the food. I will look to heaven. I will bless it. And I will break the bread. Now, both with Jesus, mind and matter both come together. And this is the really amazing thing about Jesus that we so often get wrong in our lives. You see, the miracle isn't a trick to try to prove a point or to win favor with the crowd. The miracle has meaning because it pulls past, present, and future together. We have Moses, we have the great teacher Moses and manna, but here Jesus is doing it through his apostles. We have the benevolence of the Father in heaven, and we have the abundance of the age to come, all brought into this eukairo, into this good moment. And the disciples are in wonder. Now, here's the thing about this world. We know that in the matter verse, the stakes are real. We see that in war. Bullets are real. Starvation is real. Suffering is funny, because suffering is in both, isn't it? We see that we are killing ourselves in this world one day at a time. And we don't know how to stop. There was a poignant moment in that podcast about the war when so much blood had been lost on either side that both powers saw the futility of their war, but neither felt that they could get out of it, because even the people at home wouldn't let them stop. Even as the people at home were crying out for the war to stop, what happens is things get out of our hands, things that we start. And we're in the power of another, maybe in the power of a war, or in the power of an addiction, or in the power of need. And this is our misery. Now, why doesn't Jesus just do some miracle that fixes all of this? Well, people imagine that miracles convince us. They don't. Look at the disciples. The disciples did this through Jesus. And a lot of people say, well, I'll believe in God, or I'll believe in Jesus if I see a miracle I can't doubt. Well, the disciples had a hard time believing in Jesus or understanding him. And they saw miracles they didn't doubt at all. Because we're like that. We see things one moment and then we forget it. And this is part of how we are. And so it's both our mind and our matter. And we keep flipping back between these two things, not knowing what to do. The disciples watched Jesus do this, and when faced with the threat to their welfare, the matter verse, In Jesus' arrest, they responded with violence, just like many of us would, or like Herod would, or Napoleon, or Alexander the Great. And then they fled. And then they were lost in the depression of the mind. Were we wrong? We thought God was going to act. We thought a miracle would come. We thought everything would be straightened out. Now, Jesus exposes the rule of the matter first verse with his death. If anyone's blood is to be shed, shed mine. No, that's not the way you successfully conquer in this world. You conquer by the shedding of your enemy's blood. And Jesus says, no, I will conquer with my own death, by my enemy's shedding mine. I will undo the matter first verse with my death. And then Jesus confuses the rulers of the mind first verse with his resurrection. In fact, Gnosticism was a major threat to the early church, and rival gospels were written, like the Gospel of Judas, that, you know, Judas is a hero, for he released Jesus from the matter first verse and into the mind verse, where he could be a spirit. But the canonical gospels in the Bible say no. He rose. Matter matters. Bread matters. He fed the crowd. He didn't just say, we're going on a fast today. That's sort of a real fatty thing right now, fasting. It's good for us. And so, whereas 50 years ago, fasting sounded stupid, now fasting sounds chic and cool and smart. And we always thought 3 square meals a day and a good breakfast. Now, oh, you'd better be fasting 2 days a week. Jesus confuses the rulers of the mind, first verse, with his resurrection, where he comes and he has flesh, and Thomas touches his hands and puts his hands in his side. This is not about escape into heaven or a dualism. This is the renovation and reunion of heaven and earth, mind and matter. Well, how should you live then? The matter verse matters. The mind verse matters. You should look for a ruler who rules them both. And it's not you. And it's not me. What story will you live out of? You have to live out of a story. And in fact, I differ from Pullman because I think stories are actually more powerful than bread in many ways. They go back and forth. It's a close race. Why choose between? Do you trust him enough with your matter? Do you trust him enough with your mind and your story verse?